BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Radio Dialect. We have got a packed show for you this week. It literally is packed in the studio tonight. This show is coming to you from the Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. David Lavery and Peter, who is from the AA, are here in the studio to talk about the effects of alcoholism on children and youth. There is a fresh If I Were Prime Minister slot this week. There's an interview with Anne Nick at Radio Blue in Lille, Northern France. Malcolm Greaves continues with another chapter of Cider with Rosie. Jeff Sparks is back with us this week for another edition of What's On. And we have two poems from Fiona Lindsay, a performance artist from Edinburgh, who appeared at the Halo Cafe in Bristol. And also we have Tony Lewis and Cheryl Ann from Horfield Residential Housing. But first we have a news item from Tony Gosling.
A recent report in The Guardian highlighted the problems caused by lax drinking regulations. In a report that looks at the challenges facing British police, alcohol is listed alongside gun and knife crime as one of the biggest problems. Drink-related crime and crime prevention now costs the police over £7 billion a year and costs the NHS more than £1 billion a time. The Chief Constable of Nottingham, Stephen Green, criticised the drinks industry for stretching policing to its absolute limits. Some supermarkets have taken isolated measures to restrict alcohol sales, but the main problem is the weakness of the law. The Guardian editorial recommends two solutions. Firstly, raise the price of alcohol and introduce a minimum price. And secondly, funnel profits back to the public purse to treat the damage done by excessive drinking. It also recommends that local authorities have more power over licensing. Pubs that cause trouble should be shut down, and pubs and nightclubs should pay for policing and hospitals in their neighbourhood. This will mean a high price for the drinks industry and customers, but the last few years have demonstrated that cheap drinks carry a high cost. Cheap drinks have brought about a large increase in the number of drink-related treatments needed in hospitals. In another article in The Guardian recently, an article in the health section reported that a child under 10 undergoes alcohol treatment once every 3 days. According to government figures published this month, the number of underage drinkers overall jumped by 40% from 2006 to 2007. To qualify as an alcohol-related admission, the diagnosis must mention mental and behavioural disorders due to alcohol use, alcoholic liver disease, or the toxic effects of alcohol. In a school report, over the last 4 years, 2,000 pupils have been permanently excluded from schools, a further 40,000 temporarily excluded for alcohol and drug-related incidents. The effect of this on the under-18s is linked to a number of high-risk problems: unsafe and unwanted sex, traffic and other accidents, illegal drug use, family breakdown, and a higher risk of suicide. According to the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism in the US, the chief areas of health affected by it are the adolescent brain, bones, liver, and the complex system of hormone production, which is vital to the growth and sexual development. Researchers found that young people who start to drink early, 14 years or under, may be at risk of alcohol dependence in later life, with all the health problems that it entails: liver and heart disease, some cancers, digestive disorders, and even dementia. While the government sets limits on the safe limits for adults to consume, it does not apply to those who are smaller and lighter physically. Young people have a higher tolerance to alcohol, so they can consume more before feeling the unwanted side effects. Research shows that binge drinking is far more physically harmful than a regular but moderate intake.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, thank you for that, Tony. We have in the studio with us two guests, David Lavery and Peter from AA. They're in the studio here to talk about the effects of alcoholism on young children and youth. Let's start with you, David. Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
You've had some very personal experiences with alcohol and the effects of alcohol, and some of it's fairly close to the bone. Would you like to kind of explain what it was like for you when you were growing up?
Well, there were three of us. I'm the oldest of three brothers. My father was a very intelligent man who obviously had problems, never was able to discuss whatever they were, and drank heavily as a consequence. But typical of some people, he was able to drink heavily without staggering, without slurring, and without losing his job. So he would deal with the demons, as he called them, by using alcohol. And what this created was an environment of total fear and uncertainty in the family group, because you just didn't know what mood he was going to be in. You had absolutely no idea when you came home from school whether he would be full of beans, happy, cheerful, and completely at one with the world, or whether life was a complete disaster and you just better keep out of his way.
When was this? Was it the 50s or the 60s?
It started in the 50s, but it got worse in the 60s. That was the era when we were doing secondary school. And my younger brothers, there was about 6 years between us, so one of them was very small. He really didn't understand what was going on. But the one in the middle, my middle brother, well, probably couldn't be here to talk about it tonight, because at about 9, 10 years of age, he bore the brunt of it.
Was it purely psychological, or was it physical as well?
It was psychological for us, but it was physical for my mother. He did actually attack our mother.
Okay. So this is in the 60s. Was this in Bristol? Whereabouts?
No, this was in London. My father was a Londoner. He couldn't live anywhere else. Apart from his time in the Merchant Navy, he lived in London.
So he began in the Navy, and he carried on working in the Navy.
He was in the Merchant Navy for a few years, then he came ashore and was working in catering. And of course, being in catering, he was surrounded by alcohol. He had a ready supply. He was never short of it.
Okay, the reason I'm asking about his career is trying to work out whether there was something about his environment that made him particularly prone to it. And it sounds like you can pick two more obvious professions, the Navy and catering, to be exposed to a kind of drinking culture, I guess.
Well, I think that certainly that was part of it. But I think he's an intelligent man. He was very frustrated in life. He wanted to be creative. He was trying to be creative. He did write, but he was working to get things published. He didn't succeed at that, and I think the whole range of things just got him down, and he sought solace with alcohol.
Okay. Was alcohol particularly cheap in the 60s? I mean, we're talking about some of the reasons now for there being a problem that it's very cheap. Was it cheap in the 60s?
No, I don't think it was. In fact, quite the reverse. I think relative to income, it was more expensive than now. But being in the industry he was in, catering and being a waiter, and for a lot of years he was a head waiter, it was there. He didn't have to buy it. It was there. Mm. And he could bring it home with him as well, which he did. They were glass then, they're plastic now, the little fizzy, small carbonated drinks bottles, he would bring home brandy, whiskey, bring them home in those small bottles, so he would be able to drink as much as he liked, and then he would go out in the evening to local pubs and drink.
I mean, is it that, do you think it's the case that he had this problem right from the beginning, from the very first time you could remember, or did it develop slowly during the period you were growing up? Or,
well, I think I was too young to be fair in the beginning to know what was happening, but I think it must have been going on, because just to sort of to make the thing even worse, as it were, or more disjointed or alienated for children, my mother left him twice before she finally divorced him. So I think this was going on. We were too young to understand. She was making a statement, basically. Mm. And he would convince her. This is later in life, talking to my mother as an adult. He would convince her that he had changed, he'd got on top of it, he had understood, he'd gone too far, it was going to change, and it would slip right back.
What I'm trying to get correct in my head is, are we right to blame the current problem we have with alcohol on cheap prices, or should we be looking at the reasons why people are turning to it in the first place? Is it the case that if alcohol quadrupled in cost, that we would still have a problem because the reason why people are drinking hasn't gone away and they would just keep on drinking at whatever cost?
Well, to be honest, I actually don't know the answer to that question. I don't know whether they would continue drinking at all costs or find something cheaper. I don't know. There wasn't, for all that we grew up in the 60s, there wasn't nearly as much marijuana or anything else, despite all the hype that we get from the 60s and the amount of drugs. It was much harder to get than we'd be led to believe now. So alcohol was readily available. Mm. It was, and as it is now, it's there, it's everywhere. You don't have to hunt for it, do you? I mean, I wouldn't know where to find drugs because I'm not of that age group. But alcohol, well, it's everywhere. And I think that was it. It was just readily available, which it still is.
If we brought in prohibition tomorrow, what do you think? Would that take away the reasons why people have...
No, I do not think... And forgetting America of the 30s, forgetting that. No. They prohibited drugs through the 60s. Many of my friends did try acid. They tried other things. My daughter admits, and she's 30 now, that she did try ease. We talked and talked and talked to her about it. It's not that simple. The best way is talking to one another and being open about these things and discussing them. And a programme like this is an ideal forum. Just make people aware that is the best thing you can do.
So in view of the very strong emotions that you went through when you were growing up, and we can talk about isolation and fear and alienation, what solutions are there for people who are involved in it, who have got that that problem? Who can they turn to?
Well, I don't know now. Back then, there was very little. Back then, I know there was very little, and nobody seemed to talk about it. It was just, well, that's the way it is. You married him, put up with it. I like to think that things are, that we have moved on a great deal since then.
Can I bring in Pete at this point? Peter,
good evening.
You represent an organisation here tonight, I believe, AA, which is fairly well known. What would you say to listeners who have gone through a similar experience to David, who are wondering who they can turn to?
Well, although I'm here as a recovering alcoholic, one who hadn't, which basically means I haven't had a drink for a number of days, years in fact, it's and I do not speak on behalf of the organisation. There is an organisation for those affected by the drinking of partner, loved one, mother, father, and so forth, which is known as Al-Anon Families Groups. And that can be found in all telephone directories. In Bristol, there are a number of meetings, as I well know. And I can't tell you anything about the programme under which it operates, but except to say that it is a free organisation, it is entirely self-supporting, it is entirely anonymous, and there are absolutely no conditions of membership, other than you decide you want to go. And contact can be made with that, either through the telephone directory number, which is a London number, or if anybody is sufficiently concerned, they can ring the Alcoholics Anonymous helpline on Bristol.
Sorry, can I just speak? Sorry, just to be clear, this support that is available, Peter, is that purely for the person who has the problem with the alcohol, or is it for example, other members of the family who may be collateral damage in this?
Alcoholics Anonymous will offer help to the drinker. Mm. Al-Anon Family Groups does offer help to people affected in the way that David has described. And as I said, the contact can be made through the telephone directory, finding a number in London, where people will refer you back to Bristol, or if anybody wants to speak to a member of Al-Anon, they can ring the Bristol AA helpline number, which is 926-5520. Now, that's really all I'm able to say about the Al-Anon side, the help and support for those affected by the drinking. So far as Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned, I would say in response to one of the questions you were asking, David, it's important that we understand there's a big, big fundamental difference between the alcoholic and the social drinker. And you can be a heavy social drinker. What David has described seems to me like an alcoholic, but I am in no position to say that David's father was an alcoholic. I can only speak for myself, and that's the same for every alcoholic. I know what the drink did to me. And it's essentially a case of, and it sounds as though David's father was the same, it's a concept that many people just don't understand about having no choice about whether one drank or not. I started drinking socially in my mid-teens. I had a good, fun life in my late teens and early 20s, got married, and increasingly got married, had two kids in sort of middle 20s. Increasingly, the only part of my life that was social centred on places where drink was available: the rugby club, the pub, the golf club, this sort of thing. Now, I recognise that describes me as a person in a sense, but all other alcoholics, in my experience, will tell you that the mind started to get obsessed about, if I'm going somewhere, can I get hold of alcohol? That was how I did not consider myself to be alcoholic. And within AA, we talk about crossing the line between heavy social and. And I think I crossed the line from heavy social drinking to dependent drinking in my early 30s. And I drank for another 10 years, ultimately drinking in the way that David's described his father. I had drink always around me. It didn't affect me financially. It affected my family, socially, emotionally, psychologically. I didn't lose my license. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. And in AA, we describe those things as the yets, because those things could happen to me if I decided to drink again.
Well, thank you very much to our guests, David and Peter. Really interesting to talk to you. As always, the regret that we haven't got longer. And that grey area between heavy social drinking and being an alcoholic is one that I think is a whole other interview. And whether your liver knows the difference between the two, I don't know. But again, thank you very much for joining us in the studio, David and Peter. Thank you.
Thank you.
was the Popes of Chile Town, buy one, get one free. Okay, we have Fiona Lindsay reading a poem.
I'm Fiona Lindsay. I'm an Edinburgh-based performance poet, and I've been delighted to be appearing at Acoustic Nights at the Halo Cafe in Bristol. One of the poems I did tonight is a very recent one called St Paul's Cathedral. Paul's got mental health. People won't give him money in case he spends it on drugs or alcohol. Paul's cold. A lady gave him gloves today, which was good. It was really nice of her. Paul says, thank you for buying him tea, and he'd like it from McDonald's, please, because it's cheapest there. And thank you. But he doesn't want anything to eat. He's not hungry because someone bought him a big plate of sausages and mash up the bridges. And Paul's got mental health. He misses his mum, but he likes Edinburgh. It reminds him of home. He can't go back because there's people there who beat him up because he's different. They hurt his mum and his sister, and it's his fault because he's got mental health. Paul's got mental health. He thinks maybe it's because his stepdad beat him all the time when he was little. His stepdad was an alcoholic. His mum was too. But she's been clean for 13 years now. Paul's really proud of her. He loves his mum. She says he mustn't drink or she won't talk to him. Paul says he wouldn't. It's bad for your insides. Paul's scared. He doesn't like being on the streets. He doesn't feel safe. People hurt him because he's different. Someone cut his ear off with a machete, but the doctor sewed it back. You can see where they did it. Paul's got mental health. He's supposed to take medication, but it makes him fall asleep on the street when he's begging, and people think he's gouging, so he doesn't take it. He sits in the gardens instead for the 1 o'clock gun. He likes that, and it helps him to not throw himself under buses. Paul's crying. He's going to get the Bethany bus at 9:15 and sleep in the church shelter. He doesn't like it, because it's lots of people sleeping on the floor. But he likes churches. He knows a vicar who's nice to him. Paul's lucky. There's lots of people worse off than him. He wants to do voluntary work, dig wells in Africa, help people. Paul prayed today, and someone bought him sausages and mash up the bridges. A nice lady gave him gloves, and thank you for the tea. Paul's cold. Paul's scared. Paul's got mental health. He's going to pray for me.
That was Fiona Lindsay at the Halo Cafe in Gloucester Road. If you're interested in poetry, there's a new poetry show next week for BCFM produced by the Bristol Radio Co-op. It's called Say It in Stanza, so keep an ear open for that. You can email the programme on sayitinstanza@live.com, and we'll have more details next week on how you can get involved. Our next interview guests are Tony Lewis and Cheryl Ann from Hawfield Residential Housing. And they will be talking to us about tenant management organisation. Welcome to the studio, Tony Lewis and Cheryl Ann.
Evening.
Right then. Well, big changes are afoot in the management of Bristol's council housing stock. Ever since Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s, central government has been keen to get local authorities such as Bristol City Council to relinquish its traditional role as builder and maintainer of housing, council housing, and to privatise it. Much council housing has been taken over by housing associations, but there is another possibility being offered now. That's allowing the tenants to manage the houses themselves. It's called a TMO, and I'm joined, as I said before, by Cheryl Ann and Tony Lewis, who live in Manor Farm, Hawfield area of Bristol, and are involved in one of Bristol's new TMOs. First of all, then, Cheryl and Tony, what is a TMO? What does it stand for?
TMO, Tenant Management Organisation, is literally
what it says on the tin. The tenants are organised together as a board. We go through about 18 months or so of training, and then upon a ballot of the tenants and leaseholders who are affected, they decide at the end of the process whether or not the board is competent to manage the homes as far as any housing standards and any of the policies that the housing officers would normally control, such as voids and management.
How many TMOs are there in Bristol?
We're the first one to reach this position. There are another two working with the same agent in Central and in Bedminster area. And then there's additional work happening in Barton Hill with a different agent.
So how many homes are we talking about in each TMO?
With the Hallfield Residential Housing TMO, we will be covering 1,239 homes, which is a mixture of tenants and leaseholders.
Wow. Wouldn't it just be better to let the Housing Association take over the stock?
The Housing Association, as a TMO, we are not a housing association. It's a future possibility that can always be considered. This is a way of actually protecting the tenancies at the moment.
If you're a Bristol City Council tenant, are you going to notice any difference under a TMO?
Oh, I expect to notice an enormous difference.
Go on.
The money that would normally be allocated throughout Bristol South and North under the TMO would be ring-fenced specifically to the area of Hallfield. Obviously, therefore, it could not be spent outside the area. The projects that would be delivered would be prioritised by the tenant board itself. So it's much more hands-on, it's local and it's representative.
That makes you wonder how the council ran its housing stock before the TMO was invented. Will you be able to build new social housing?
I understand once we've been running for 2 or 3 years, we will be able to look at that option.
Okay. And what kind of aspirations would you have in terms of a quantity of new housing?
Our specific area covers mainly around the Hallfield and not Leeds area, so it would be centred around there.
Okay.
And the other TMOs would take care of developments in their own area as
sure.
well.
And what are seen as the priority areas in Bristol apart from Hallfield? Are there any kind of hotspots?
Well, we'd like to see the entire city go over to tenant management.
Right, okay. And why is central government trying to get councils to give up their role in housing people?
I think the enormous housing lists themselves are evident of a complete shortage of housing available. There's an awful lot of budget that's taken up with management. As a result of that, it's getting harder and harder for them to deliver the service from a central position.
Right. It'd be useful for listeners if you have a website for us to have that detail. Do you have a website to give us?
No, I'm afraid we don't at the moment. We're in the development and feasibility stage currently. We're not actually live as a TMO as yet.
Okay. So when would you hope to have a website? Are we talking a few months? Or?
Between February and the end of March next year.
Okay, so early next year. And where can we find out more about TMOs? If there's no website,
well, we could suggest through our own agent, who are Open Communities.
Okay, have Open Communities got a phone number?
Yes, I can hear
a bit of paper being rustled there. You've got a phone number.
We have indeed.
Okay, so this is the phone number for your TMO.
No, this is the telephone number for our agent.
The agent, okay.
Who is the agent for three of the current four TMOs within Bristol.
Mm.
It's Open Communities. Their telephone number is 0121 766 3161, and the contact is Mr. Mark Hibbard.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Cheryl Ann and Tony Lewis, for joining us in Dialect this evening. And we wish you all the best in managing your new stock of over 1,000 of Bristol's homes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, if there's ever anything that really bugs you in today's world, we have a brand new feature for you called If I Was Prime Minister, and already the volunteers are coming thick and fast. We've not been able to have them all this week, so we just have one for you, and it's Matt Jago, and he's talking about what it's like to cycle through the centre of Bristol. Well, welcome back to the studio. We have another Prime Minister with us today. It's Matt Jago. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Right, Matt, you have entered a parallel universe whereby you are Prime Minister for the day and you get to make any law you want. It could be to do with Bristol, the UK or the world, anything you like. All right, it's over to you.
OK, well, at the moment I'm having a lot of problems with car drivers. I'm a cyclist, so I use my bike as my main method of transport to get around the city. And I have daily altercations with drivers who seem to have no consideration whatsoever for other road users, other more vulnerable road users, be they motorcyclists or push cyclists.
I'm going to just check with you, Matt. Are you wearing your lights, your reflector jacket, everything else?
I do. I have an orange high-vis jacket. I've got flashing red lights on the back and a pretty bright light on the front as well. So it's not like I can't be seen. What I'm talking about as well is daylight, broad daylight, first thing in the morning, during the rush hour, cars cutting into bus lanes, not even looking, and cutting up cyclists and causing all sorts of problems. And what I think is that with what is seeming to be an ever-increasing sort of mode of transport around the city, and a sensible mode of transport around the city, it seems to me that car drivers need educating in what it means to drive around a city where there are a high volume of cyclists. It seems to me a lot of them don't know how to deal with it.
I mean, do you think there's that in the past that car drivers didn't have to deal with a high volume of cyclists, and now for various economic and environmental reasons you get a lot more people on the bikes, a lot more bikes around, and they're just not used to it?
Possibly. I mean, there is definitely a higher volume of cyclists. I mean, particularly around Bristol, the traffic's terrible. People are turning to cycling as a more viable option. It's often quicker if you live relatively close to the centre of the city to get into the middle of town on a push bike. It's cheap, it's economical, it's environmentally sound, and it just seems to make more sense. And part of it is probably that, yes, but part of it, I think, is also drivers' attitudes towards cyclists. There's a lot of that sort of road rage mentality in the morning when they're sat there not moving and cyclists are whizzing past. Maybe people don't like it, I don't know.
Right, so as Prime Minister then, you've done a good job of highlighting the problem that many people listening to the show will recognise, I hope. Although I suspect if you're a car driver, you're going to see it differently. But a lot of people who ride their bikes will understand what you're saying. But the point is, you're Prime Minister, you've got the chance to actually come up with a solution. So what would your solution be to the problem?
My solution would be compulsory schooling of new drivers as part of the test. This may be happening already in terms of specifically dealing with cyclists and motorcyclists, and compulsory re-education of existing drivers who've had their licences for some time who may not be used to dealing with this volume of traffic. I would also say, on top of this, that I would say that you would need compulsory training of cyclists themselves, because I appreciate there's a lot of cyclists don't do themselves any favours at all, and there's a couple of people I know who's not going to be too long before they have an accident, and it will be through no fault of any driver on the road, it'll be through their own fault. So I think to a certain extent you've got to look at both sides of it and basically just re-educate people generally to the volume of cyclists on the road.
So basically you'd be offering something more than the current government is doing towards sorting this out, making it a higher priority.
I would like to think that as part of the cycling initiative that's going on in Bristol at the moment, that part of the huge amount of money that's been invested in that will be towards educating people to what is going to become an ever increasingly popular method of transport. It's necessary, and if it doesn't, there's going to be all sorts of problems, and I don't know.
Any countries we can look up to and aspire to and learn from that's got moved further ahead with this kind of thing?
Not that I've had any experience of personally, but I mean,
I'm thinking of the Netherlands, perhaps.
Yeah. Certainly, there's models to be used out there, and you can take possibly examples from Asia as well, where there's, you know, apparently there's 9 million bicycles in Beijing. You know,
are you going to be sending your transport minister on a case study visit to these countries to learn more? Then
I think we'd have to be doing that. Yeah, we're looking at certainly what's good about what other people are doing and taking those. Taking those examples for ourselves, definitely. Certainly in the city where, like I said, we are supposed to be a cycling innovative cycling city.
I know in New York they have. I think it's New York. I don't think it's the only city in the world that does it, but they have a day in the week. I think it's a Sunday where they actually close all streets off to cars and it's basically given over to bikes for a whole day. Like I said, on a Sunday. So what do you reckon?
Fantastic, yeah. Great idea.
We can look forward to that in Bristol.
Let's hope so.
All right, cheers. Thank you very much, Matt.
No problem.
Well, that was Matt Jago, and he was Prime Minister for the day, and that was his thoughts on cycling in Bristol. And now, once again, it's time for Side with Rosie, abridged especially for Dialect Radio and read by the actor Malcolm Greaves. I really look forward to this every week.
Sided with Rosie by Laurie Lee. The air revolved around the village, the festivals around the air, the church around the festivals, the squire round the church, and the village round the squire. The squire was our centre, a crumbling moot tree, and few indeed of our local celebrations could take place without his shade. On the greater occasions he let us loose in his gardens. On the smaller gave us buns and speeches, and at historic moments of national rejoicing, when kings were born, enemies vanquished, or the Conservatives won an election, he ransacked his box rooms for fancy dresses, that we might rejoice in a proper manner. The first big festival I can remember was Peace Day in 1919. It was a day of magical transformations, of tears and dusty sunlight, of bands, processions and buns by the cartload, and I was so young that I thought it normal. We had all been provided with fancy dress, and that seemed normal too. Apart from the squire's contribution, Marjorie had been busy for weeks stitching up glories for ourselves and the neighbours. No makeshift ragbag cobbling either. Marjorie had worked as though for a wedding. On the morning of the feast, Poppy Green came to the house to try on her angel's dress. She was 5 years old and about my size. She had russet curls like apple peelings, a polished pumpkin face, a fruity air of exploding puddings, and a perpetual cheeky squint. I loved her. She was like a portable sweet shop. This morning I watched my sisters dress her. She was supposed to represent a spirit. They'd made her a short frilly frock, a tinfoil helmet, cardboard wings, and a wand with a star. When they'd clothed her, they stood her up on the mantelpiece and had a good look at her. Then they went off a while on some other business and left us alone together. "Fly," I commanded. "You got wings, ain't you?" Poppy squirmed and wriggled her shoulders. I grew impatient and pushed her off the mantelpiece, and she fell with a howl into the fireplace. Looking down at her, smudged with coal and tears, her wand and wings all crumpled, I felt nothing but rage and astonishment. She should have been fluttering around the room. I sponged and soothed her, and Poppy trotted home, her bent wand clutched in her hand. Then shapes and phantoms began to run through the village, and we started to get ready ourselves. Marge appeared as Queen Elizabeth, with Phyllis as her lady-in-waiting. Marjorie, who was 16 and at her most beautiful, wore a gown of ermine. She filled the kitchen with such a glow of grace that we just stood and gaped at her. The rest of us whom Marjorie had dressed were the result of homespun inspirations. Dorothy as Knight was perhaps the most arresting. An apparition of unearthly beauty, a flash of darkness, a strip of nocturnal sky. I smelt frost when I saw her. and heard a crackling of stars. Familiar Dorothy had grown far and disturbing. Brother Jack had refused to get dressed up at all unless in some aspect of recognised valour. So they hung him in green, gave him a bow and arrow, and he called himself Robin Hood. Little Tony was dressed as a market girl, curly-headed and pretty as love, bare-armed and bonneted, carrying a basket of flowers, but so proud we forgave him his frock. As for me, a squat neck and solid carriage made the part I should play inevitable. I was John Bull, whoever he was, but I quickly surmised his importance. I wore a top hat and choker, a Union Jack waistcoat, a frock coat and pillowcase breeches. But I'd been finished off hurriedly with gaiters of cardboard, fastened loosely together with pins, a slovenly makeshift which offended my taste and which I was never able to forgive. This piece day I remember as a blur of colour leading from fury to triumph. There was a procession with a band. I walked along solemnly. Fantastic disguises surrounded me. Every single person seemed covered with beards, false noses, bootblack and wigs. I had not marched far when my boots fell off, followed by my cardboard gaiters. As I stopped to find them, the procession swept over me. I sat down by the roadside and howled. I howled because I could hear the band disappear, because I was John Bull, and it should not have happened. I was picked up by a carriage, restored to the procession, and then placed on a trolley and pulled. Cross-legged on the trolley, barefooted and gaiterless, I rode like a prince through the village. The old and infirm stood and cheered from the gutters. I nodded back for my trolley. On the steps of the manor stood the wet-eyed squire, already in tears at the sight of us. His mother, in a speech from a basket chair, mentioned the glory of God, the empire, us, and said we wasn't to touch the flowers. When the procession dispersed, I was tipped off the trolley and wandered away through the grounds. Flags and roses moved against the sky, bright figures among the bushes. I saw Charlie Chaplin, Peter the Pieman, a collection of upright tigers, a wounded soldier about my age, and a bride on the arm of a monkey. Later I was given a prize by the squire and was photographed in a group by a rockery. I still have that picture. All sepia shadows, a leaf ripped from that summer day. Surrounded by girls in butter muslin, by druids and eastern kings, I am a figure rooted in unshakable confidence, oval, substantial, and proud. Others I recognise are gathered all around me, all marked by that day's white dust. Tony has lost his basket of flowers, Jack his bow and arrow. Poppy Green has had her wings torn off and is grasping a broken lily. She stands beside me, squinting fiercely, ruffled a bit by the heat, and the silver letters across her helmet, which then I couldn't read, say, peace.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Dialect Radio's Anthea Page was in Lille in northern France and dropped into the regional radio station and brought us this report, an interview with one of the presenters.
So I'm in France Bleu Nord, which is the radio station in Lille in the north of France, and I'm talking to...
Annick.
And can you tell us, Annick, your job at the radio, please?
Alors, je suis animatrice.
So I am a radio speaker here.
Je vais parler de France Bleu Nord parce que c'est une radio importante dans la région. On dépend de Radio France, donc qui est un grand groupe français avec différentes espaces.
So I'm going to talk about Radio Bleu, which is a part of Radio France, which is one of our very important radio stations in France.
Et nous sommes une radio régionale.
And we are a regional radio station.
So are you like the BBC, which has the regional BBC stations?
Ben, probablement, je ne connais pas bien le fonctionnement de la BBC, je connais de manière globale mais pas précise.
So very probably, yes, I don't know exactly how the BBC works, but I have a feeling that's about it, that's about the same.
En France, on a, France Bleu est un réseau de plus de 40 stations locales.
So France Bleu in France is a network of about 40 stations.
Oh, c'est grand.
Oui, voilà, donc nous ici c'est France Bleu Nord.
So this is France Bleu North,
voilà.
Nord.
Avec un programme de 6h le matin jusqu'à 23h le soir, avec un réseau qui est à Paris, avec des journaux qui sont faits par Paris et des journaux qui sont faits ici aussi en région.
Okay, with a program spanning from 6 in the morning until 11 at night. And we have some programs are sort of set up in Paris and others are set up here locally.
On est une grosse locale ici, c'est une des premières qui a été créée sur le réseau en 1981.
Okay, so this is a station which is quite big. It was created in 1981.
What's your program in the morning, usually?
Alors, le matin, effectivement, sont des émissions. Les matinales sont construites beaucoup autour de l'information, avec l'information nationale, internationale et régionale.
Okay, so the morning programs are focused on the news, the local news and the national news.
And international
and
news.
International
yes.
news. I knew I was forgetting something.
Oh, right. And the afternoon, it's more plays, is it, music?
Oui, l'après-midi, effectivement, c'est beaucoup une place qui est réservée à la musique. Mais le matin aussi, après 9h, on a un programme où on parle aux gens, on s'intéresse à la vie des gens avec des rendez-vous qu'on appelle les rendez-vous d'experts et qui parlent des problèmes de la vie quotidienne.
Okay, so after 9, our program deals with our listeners. We talk to our listeners directly, and we talk and we call these programs experts. Oui. Point
de téléphone. Les gens téléphones, oui, voilà. Et l'après-midi, effectivement, c'est plus musical. On parle de cinéma aussi beaucoup parce que on sait que ça intéresse beaucoup les gens en France de parler de cinéma. On reçoit aussi des artistes. Je sais que cette semaine, on va recevoir la semaine à venir, on va recevoir des acteurs de cinéma, Karine Viard notamment, qui est une belle actrice française pour les avant-premières.
So in the afternoon we're sort of more devoted to music and cinema. Cinema is a big thing for us. And we are soon going to receive Karine Viard, who is quite a well-known actress.
Voilà, on s'adresse nous aux habitants du Nord et du Pas-de-Calais.
Okay. Our audience is located in the north, which is a département, which is like a county, if you like, and Pas-de-Calais, which is another département, smaller than a county.
Okay. Yeah. And do you concentrate on French cinema? Or all cinema.
C'est effectivement puisqu'on va recevoir quand on a la possibilité de recevoir les artistes parce qu'ils viennent présenter leurs films en avant-première, on reçoit des acteurs ou des réalisateurs français. C'est vrai qu'on fait pas trop dans le cinéma international parce que les artistes internationaux vont à Paris et pas en région.
So we tend to receive, yes, we do receive French. French actors and actresses because the international actors will go to Paris and not come to Lille, which is a regional radio station.
Les équipes de tournage qui viennent sur Lille sont des équipes françaises.
Okay, so in Lille, in fact, all sorts of films are actually shown, but the shooting teams are who come here
oui,
are
voilà.
French.
Mm.
So what's the next big event that you will cover in terms of people coming to Lille or international?
On fait aussi, nous, sur cette antenne, c'est qu'on offre beaucoup d'invitations, beaucoup de places pour aller au concert, pour aller au cinéma, pour aller voir des matchs de foot aussi. Donc, on est quand même dans une version très régionale.
So we do what we do do actually is send in invitations to cinemas, to football matches on a regional basis.
Il y a une part aussi importante dans notre radio, c'est d'accompagner les gens qui sont sur la route, parce qu'on est une grosse métropole où ça circule beaucoup, avec beaucoup d'embouteillages, et c'est vrai que le matin et en fin de journée, on accompagne les gens en voiture pour leur signaler les problèmes sur la route.
What we do, as this is a very big urban area, we tend to give a lot of traffic advice, if you like, for people who are on the road. In their cars.
Thank you very much.
Avec plaisir.
Thank you, Anthea. And now, once again, it's time for Jeff Sparks, who's come into the studio with Quality What's On for you this week.
Thank you, Matt. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 27th of November, at the Croft in Bristol, the Subhumans will be performing with support from Valdez and Da Capo. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. Moving on to Friday, 28th of November, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, RSVP will be performing with support from Bag of Rats. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Song of the Week, and this week I bring to you a band from Newcastle upon Tyne who, despite their turbulent and unpredictable history, they are still going to this day. I am, of course, talking about the Wild Hearts. This is the song Caffeine Bomb, which is from their debut album, Earth vs. the Wild Hearts, which was released in 1994. Was the Wild Hearts with Caffeine Bomb. For more information on them, you can check out www.thewildhearts.com and also www.myspace.com/thewildhearts. Moving on to Saturday 29th November, and at the Fleece in Bristol, Whole Lotta Lead will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on 29th of November, and at the Old Duke in Bristol, Flash Harry will be performing. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on Sunday 30th of November, and at Cheltenham Town Hall, Show of Hands will be performing with support from Oyoari Joseph. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £17 each. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Cheers, Jeff. And we got another poem by Fiona Lindsay.
Hi, I'm Fiona Lindsay and this poem is called Vodka Tonic. Sitting on a red bench, leatherette. Fluorescent sky highlights the beer stains and cigarette burns on the twisted table, top wet with spilled tears and lies. Side by side, he cries for comfort denied by the red cap poking from his pocket. Russian white writing with a clear inside.
That was Fiona Lindsay. You can contact her on barefoot_poet@yahoo.co.uk. The end of this week's Radio Dialect show from Bristol Radio Co-op, based in the city centre. Today's studio guests were David Lavery and Peter from AA, Tony Lewis and Cheryl Ann from Horfield Residential Housing. We had If I Was Prime Minister, Matt Jager reading that this week. Malcolm Greaves read another excellent instalment of Cider with Rosie, to be continued next week. And reporters for Dialect Radio were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Fiona Lindsay composed and read the poems. What's on Guide from Jeff Sparks. Vilas Chichikaran was studio engineer, ably supported by Kayleigh Porter. And Mark, I'm afraid to say, is still mending himself after the accident on his bike last week. Hope you recover well from that, Mark. And this week's show was produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. So it's goodbye from all of us here at Radio Dialect.